Chapter 16. Blob of Dark. Lugano in 1800 was taking up its share of a world population that had more than doubled since Leonardo's time, to a staggering 1 billion people worldwide. Thomas Malthus was already whinging to his hyperloined compatriots that such an uncontrolled population increase would soon overwhelm the capacity of the planet to cope. The lake looked as precious jewelly as ever, with massive dollops of lush and associated green around a broad and vibrant bay, random pixeled by scattering sunlight and post-storm clearance sails of leisure and fishing craft. If the lake and mountains looked much the same, as did the odd church spire, just about everything else about the town had undergone changements since Leonardo's time. Elegant buildings now frocked the lake from one end of the bay to the other, and had even begun their conquest of the slopes that commandeered the town. After being ferried across the lake and being ripped off outrageously by the ferryman, they entered the town unannounced. But, despite his false moustache, whether a military procession of several hundred heavily armed cavalry, with Napoleon Bonaparte at its head, could be considered incognito, may be a legitimate subject of debate. They entered the brand new Grand Old Café, where they partook of a hot chocolate. So why are you granting Ticino independence and making it part of the new Switzerland? Why do you want to keep Lugano from the Italians so much? Asked Sean. Not Lugano. Napoleon signed Sean to lean forward so he could whisper, La maison. The house? Which house? Whispered Sean, adopting the conspiratorial tone. The haunted house. The house Leonard and Luca Pacioli built for Francesco del Giocondo. That's Italian for Frankie the Playboy, winked Napoleon, whose first language had been Italian. The husband of Madonna Lisa, added Laplace. The girl with the magic smile, went on Napoleon whimsically. His Excellency has a crush on Mona Lisa, explained the ex-marquis. Did Sean detect the slightest tone of jealousy in his voice?
Every person puts a squeeze, her crush, on the Mona Lisa, thundered Napoleon, making everyone jump back.
Then he leaned forward again, and Sean could feel the whole café leaning in as well to catch the words of the great little man.
Why do you think I keep her hidden in my stocking drawer? If you see what I find out.
He shook himself.
But she loves me. She told me herself she cannot go even half a day without her nappy.
Sean thought it best to change the subject. Why did you say haunted house?
I didn't. I said haunted house. A legend has grown around the strange phenomena of this area. People disappearing, ghostly appearances. Certain places are considered possessed by demons.
I have one of those myself, said Laplace. A legend? Asked Sean. No, a demon. My demon says that the universe is like a wound-up clockwork mechanism, explained the ex-marquis, unwinding and unwinding on an entirely predictable course. Every planet, every rock, us included, are doomed to follow a predestined path. No free will? Asked Sean, somewhat shocked.
That is why it is called a demon, went on Napoleon.
My demon, continued Laplace, sees all, will devour all, in his relentless quest to run down the universe. Till the universe just stops? Asked Sean, merging his thoughts of the timeline crisis with uneasy feeling. Yes. And then what? Newton has shown us that it is not just a question of all objects falling to the earth, but that anything at all with a bit of substance to its name will attract anything else substantial. A substantial enough argument. It is therefore only the temporary speed of planets which keeps them in orbit, and thus far able to keep a respectful distance from the sun and each other, but it only delays their inevitable doom. Cheerful philosophy, said Sean. And it is your demon that is making them slow down? Well, I have calculated that if enough matter were to collect together, for example in a massive sun, then nothing would ever have the velocity, the necessary oomph, to escape from it again. Nothing?
Sean felt one of those premonition tingly things downstairs.
Nothing, Laplace nodded. Now, this is the really interesting bit. If Newton is right, and light is a stream of particles and not a wave, because a wave needs something to wave through, then not even light would be able to escape the gravitational enticement. Perpetually dark it would be. A great big blob of dark, he finished with a flourish of fingers, as if neon lanterning the final words.
Come now, Laplace, teased the First Consul. Surely you can think of as nasier names than the blob of dark.
What about black hole? Suggested Sean, knowing that term wouldn't be used for another century and a half.
Catchy, but no.
Laplace shook his ex-aristocratic head. It's more of a blob than a hole, but thank you for trying.
Sean sat forward on the elegant café bench.
Ex-Marquis de Laplace, do you think time could be drawn into such a whole, blob as well?
He hesitated, but dearly wanted, to ask whether that would explain what was happening to him, the haunted house, and the whole timeline. Throughout this discussion, Napoleon had been playing with a circular red, white, and blue pennant on his enormous hat, spinning it, and seeing if he could keep it turning with his breath. He answered for Laplace.
What is more important is that so many of the most famous oracles and fortune-tellers come from this area.
Is that why we are here? Asked Sean, dawningly. So that you can have your fortune told?
And what a fortune that is, murmured Napoleon.
Yes, but more than that, we are here because of them.
He pointed through the window at the guard's horsemen, who were still trying to get into the café, but were being stopped by the proprietor on account that the horses weren't cleaning their shoes properly.
Napoleon leaned forward and whispered into Sean's ear,
You know who they are, don't you?
No, remitted Sean.
The invertebrates.
What? Cried Sean in a panic. They'll take me.
Not if I am protecting you. Not while you give me a reason to protect you. We understand each other, Sean. I think so, we.
The waiter brought another round of hot chocolates.
They are looking for something, isn't it, Sean? Something that one time belonged, I think, to you. How do you think I know about the sang real, the holy grail?
The watch? Last time I saw it was in 1699, being taken by the Bernoulli brothers to Switzerland on the Rhine Line holiday cruise boat while they still had a special weekend rate. What happened to it after that?
Napoleon nodded to Laplace, who said, They gave it to Euler.
But it doesn't need lubrication.
No, not an Euler. Euler, Leonard Euler, the master of all we mathematicians, codename the Owl.
A Swiss genius and prolific dealer in equations.
He specialized in smuggling the good uncut stuff across the rubber wall.
Rubber wall?
Yes, to the east, where all mathematics knowledge had been erased. He got through to St. Petersburg, where Catherine the Great employed him to cook her books for her. That was her mistake. When it comes to cooking, you should always call on a French mathematician, not a Swiss, said Laplace superiorly, with matching French world orientation.
And the Owl took the watch with him?
Yes.
Then what happened to it?
They called her Tsarina Kath, the lover of math. She was so impressed, she had a special ornate egg built for it, one of those Matryoshka things the tourists love, which have a series of decorative eggs nested inside each other. But the last of the eggs she used was not just any egg. It was a stone egg, from here, Lugano, suspiciously enough supplied by the Bernoulli family itself. He pointed across the street where a shop window displayed a sign saying,
Official agent for Bernie Bros, Oracle and Alchemist's Quality Suppliers, Philosopher's Masonry Art Speciality.
There's still a thriving business for miracle merchandising here in Switzerland.
Ah, thought Sean. And when they went to put the watch inside.
Exactly, concluded Laplace. On cracking the egg, the watch disappeared.
And reappeared here, in Lugano, in the haunted house, said Napoleon triumphantly.
I see, said Sean.
As I told you, I found the Codex of Leonard in 1796 and read it in the Miroir
when Josie was not using it.
Did you like it?
The histoire drags in parts, but the plot was riveting. It told me everything about Yu Shan and the house and the eggs. But it stops at the disappearance of the bearer of the watch.
He tapped the side of his long nose with his trigger finger.
At that point, history tells us two things happened. Leonard is invited to work freelance for Cesare Borgia, a real son of a pope, who suddenly gains great power and starts an incredibly violent campaign across Italy, posing as the exclusive agent of Monsieur Biggie.
Napoleon smiled.
A man who put his battle axe where his faith is. And secondly, Leonard became obsessed with the Mona Lisa and took her with him everywhere. And finally, they went to France together for his terminal holiday. And the interesting thing is that he never finished the painting. He kept touching her up till the day he died.
Why?
That is what I'm asking you. Why, Sean Sulpier? Why?
I have no idea, really. Ask him what he did next, whispered Laplace. So what did you do next? Asked Sean.
Well, of course, I invaded Egypt.
Perfectly logical. Why not? One of your umers? Asked Sean.
Yes, but there was also a connection. You know about Jean le Miserere, isn't it?
The scribe of Archimedes, prompted Laplace. Sean nodded dumbfoundedly.
Napoleon continued. I took a whole group of academics with me, scientists and scholars. I rented a harem in Cairo as a multi-use facility and set up a populaire, très populaire centre of, amongst other things, learning. It was also the cover for my secret centre of operation to find the Miserere copy of Archimedes' notebook.
We knew there had to be a hard copy still standing, added Laplace.
I needed to know what was recorded in Archimedes' parchment notebook, his palimpsest. I had a go at getting through to Constantinople for the original, but the museum library was closed for the duration of the war.
What war? The war he was waging against the Turks trying to get to Constantinople, answered Laplace.
Also, my plans were thwarted. I think that is the word, thwarted by the birth-addicted English.
They sank all his nice boats, clarified Laplace. Napoleon smashed the cup he was holding onto the head of a passing waiter, his quaint way of asking for another round of chocolate.
Yes, the toss-winning swine played cricket with their cannonballs against the sides of my ships, bouncing them off the water, and they went down clean and bowled by how those cochons say, yokers. A new tactic. Anyway, my man, Capitaine Bouchard, eventually found the Rosetta Stones.
Stones, surprised Packshorn. I thought there was only one.
Naha, my ploy worked. We found two. The measure stone we kept for ourselves. The other was nothing more than a shipping list from Pharaoh Ptolemy, the next in line. We left it for the shopkeeper English. And returned to France with a real stone.
So what does Archimedes say on the measure of stone? Asked Sean, intrigued. Laplace answered. There were some scribbled notes in the margins, reminders about getting his sandals reshod and things like that. However, he does eventually get around to mentioning a certain one stone, as the translation from Greek has it. But the hieroglyphic attachments suggest that one stone could be a misback translation for only stone,
which in French is seul pierre,
triumphed Napoleon. Ah, contributed Sean. And Archimedes left you a message.
A message? For me?
You see, Sean, went on Laplace, Archimedes knew a secret which scholars have been looking for ever since. The Romans wanted it suppressed, but there was one Roman, Cicero, who came 100 years after the sacking of Syracuse to find Archimedes' tomb, hoping to find some clue to his secret.
And the message?
Do not disturb my circles. Sean was disappointed.
Meaning what?
Watch where you put your dirty great sandals. That, or guard the Spici Celesti from the Romans.
I don't see the connection, admitted Sean,
getting progressively more confused with each explanation. Speaky Celesti is the mystic language of the gods. It reveals the workings of the circles, or Galileo's orbits. That's why Pi is so important. In the final match of his series against the Vatican Old Boys, Galileo left posterity one of the most famous soundbites ever. And yet it moves. Referring to the Earth moving around the Sun, remember guest Sean. It was the greatest challenge the Church had ever received. What you see versus what you choose to see. Keeping your eye on the ball, an unequal contest in philosophical football, surely, said Sean. You would think so. But it is surprisingly difficult to win when your opponents are also the referees, so Galileo was disqualified. Why? Offside. The Vatican ruled that nobody was allowed to be on the opposing side during matches against them. Technicalities, muttered Napoleon. That's why Isaac Newton changed strategies, continued Laplace. Why he needed to move in on the London maths mob to sink the church-sponsored royal barge.
Barge? Said Sean.
Yes, the king kept barging in on intellectual freedom. He threatened to take the spin out of the scientific revolution. Sean remembered his days in Cambridge.
The wheel turneth.
Yes, in those days you had to be a priest to be a professor. Thanks to Isaac Barrow's help, Newton was the first who wasn't. Exactly. Till Newton arrived on the scene, actually knowing things was still considered an optional extra, and often a dangerous one. Intellectuals moved not so much in circles as holding patterns.
What resulted was a dirty war between two gangs, the Sacks and the Socks, for control of the London Underground, added Napoleon.
Yes, remembered Sean. The Sacks were the Isaac Sparrow and Newton, and the Socks were the Royal Society.
Newton eventually won. Careers were found floating belly up in the Thames.
The Swiss did well out of it. Running royalty-free equations to both sides of the channel, said Sean, remembering the shadowy figures of the Bernoulli brothers slipping away down the Thames. It was thanks to them that the debate escalated into a full-scale pan-European conflict, a conflict that has been raging between English and continental mathematicians for more than a century. To our advantage, Laplace added. Why is that? Exclusion principle. For example, the currently reigning English genius, Thomas Young, does not stand a chance of publishing his wave theory of light, because this suggests that Newton was not infallible. The English have made a religion out of Newton's version of Speaky Celesti, so now they are stagnating, isolated, leaving the field wide open for us.
And the Sangreal? Asked Sean.
That is what started it all. That is what Archimedes wanted to tell you.
But how can that be? What about the TPF, the time paradox failsafe? How is it possible for me to travel from the future and leave something like a digital watch that changes history and causes me to travel back in the first place?
Laplace smiled in that way only mathematicians can when faced by an irresolvable and complex riddle. I think the answer lies in that the first place. My theory that a blob that could be large enough to mop up everything, even light, could be a clue. If a blob of dark appeared suddenly near the Earth, we wouldn't at first notice any change, because everything would be drawn towards it at the same time. Till we actually entered it, we would think everything is normal. Perhaps that is what is happening with you and the watch. And somehow the haunted house holds the answer to this riddle.
Leonardo and Luca Pacioli knew this, or discovered it by accident. But only after you disappeared, perhaps because you disappeared. They worked it out and left clues about it for you to discover. Secret clues, because there are forces out there prepared to do anything to squash all knowledge of it. Napoleon put his cards on the table.
We hold some of the pieces of this riddle, and you hold the others. It is in both our interests to collaborate on a solution.
Before Sean could answer, Napoleon called out,
Garçon, today I am feeling generous. Is that not right, Bourienne?
His secretary hurriedly searched for and then threw his agenda.
Today, yes, today you are generous, magnanimous, and gentle.
And tomorrow?
Brutal patches, but otherwise calm.
So I have decided to pay my bill.
Oh, thank you, most sublimate conqueror,
pseudo-groveled the relieved proprietor of the grand old café. When the bill arrived, Napoleon took one look at it and passed it hurriedly to Bourrienne. Bourrienne patted his pockets and said, "I left the state coffer in my other jacket." Napoleon then passed the bill to the ex-marquis. "Laplace, old friend, I'm a bit short till the end of the month." Laplace looked down on him. "Why only to the end of the month? Back in Paris, I intend to become too big for my boots." The mathematician looked at the bill and swore in hypercolic vectors as he dug in his pockets for some larger notes than the shrapnel he had prepared. Napoleon slipped off the bench and instantly lost several inches of majesty. "Gentlemen, it is time for us to pay the ghosts of Lugano a visit,"